I want to start today by turning to Proverbs 3. Proverbs 3. There was a college student one day who was had asked to participate in a project in the class, a science project, and they were to each one of the students pick a means to demonstrate a various law of physics. One of the students decided he would demonstrate the law of the pendulum. So he stood before the class when his time came up, and he took 20 minutes and he explained about the laws governing a swinging pendulum. And he explained to the class how the pendulum can never return to the point from which it starts. It never can go higher from the point at which it's released from. Because of friction and gravity, you see, the return of the pendulum will always fall short of its original start point. And each time it swings, it's going to end up making less of an arc. And finally, it will come to a complete rest. And this is called a state of equilibrium. And all forces acting on the pendulum at that point are equal. So to demonstrate this, the student got a 3-foot-long cord, a string, and he tied a fairly large bolt on the end of it, and he tacked it on top of the chalkboard in the class. And he took the end of that bolt over to the edge of the chalkboard, held it up real high, and then he let it swing. And he made a mark there. And it would swing out, and it would swing back, and then he'd make another mark. And then it would swing out and swing back, and he'd make another mark. And he showed everyone how that each time it would swing less and less of a piece of the travel until eventually, after about a minute, it came to a standstill, a rest. After this demonstration, the marks were very clear. He had proven his point, and he asked the class, "Do you believe in the law of the pendulum?" All the hands in the room, they all went up together. Even the instructor's hand went up. And the instructor began to walk up to the front of the classroom because he thought the demonstration was over. But he didn't realize the demonstration really had just begun. So at this point, the student asked the teacher, would he be willing to participate in an experiment? He asked the teacher. Teacher said, sure he would. So he pulled back the chalkboard, and there behind the chalkboard was about 250 pounds of weights, and they were tied up with 4 parachute cords. And they were hanging from a large steel girder from the top of the ceiling. And so he took the instructor and he put him against the wall and sat him in a chair that was seated there. And he pulled these weights up to about within an inch of the nose of that instructor. And he said to the instructor, looking him in the eye, "Do you still believe in the law of the pendulum?" And the instructor paused for quite some time and nodded yes. And so the student let the weights go. And they swung in this incredible arc towards the other side of the wall, paused, and began to return back towards the instructor. And the student said he never saw a man move as fast in his life. The instructor literally dove out of the chair. And so the student then said, "Perhaps this was only theoretical," to the instructor. And so I ask us today about us and about our lives. We believe in trusting in God. We believe in God. We believe in what He teaches. We believe in His laws and His way of life. But when it comes to reality, is it only theoretical? It's a great question to ask, isn't it? It's a wonderful question to ask. And it may be one of the most single important factors to you and I who live at the end of the age, Will we really believe in God, and will we trust Him with our lives? In this context, remember what Jesus said at the end of the age? When I come, will I find faith on the earth? Will He? Will He find real faith, real belief, people who that trust Him, completely trust Him? Or will He come and find a people who know all the right doctrines? Will He come to a people who attend church on Saturday and yet are apathetic about the things of God and not strong in their belief? Are they casual about it? I submit to you today, when Jesus Christ comes, when He comes back to this earth, He is going to find people who completely trust in Him with all their heart. The question today is this: will it be you and me? Will it be us that are those people that trust Him? He's going to find some. And so in this context, I ask us to read Proverbs 3 and verse 5. God speaking to us. And here He says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths." How much do we believe this? How much do we trust God with our own heart? How much do we not lean to our own understanding, but how much do we acknowledge Him in everything in our life? And how much do we let Him direct our paths? Do we trust Him with our whole heart? Admittedly, this has to be hard to do in the world that we live in today, because we live in a modern world, and the world is a jaded world. It's a world of ripoffs, isn't it, that we live in today? It wasn't always so. Earlier in man's history, men believed in God. In fact, almost to an extreme that was perverse. In the Middle Ages, for example, they believed if a leaf fell from a tree, that an angel carried it. And that's how much they thought of God being a part of their life. But then an industrial revolution came, didn't it? And man no longer needed to trust in God. He realized everything worked according to natural laws. And this way, man could use those laws. He could direct his own future. And so man came to believe in science. He came to believe in himself. Now we live in a world today in which man is finding out that he can trust in very little, very little, if you think about it. You know, when it comes to science, we've witnessed now so many cases where there have been articles, research articles, that have been proven with false data, flat out lies. And we've seen over and over again things like the thalidomide scandal, where people have pushed their stuff and people have suffered terribly for it at the hands of science. And so now people are more suspicious. They tell us this is what works and we shouldn't use this, and then later we find out, oh no, this produces cancer. And so people don't trust science anymore like they used to, and over 50 to 60% in polls today say they don't trust government. You know, they have so many reports like, ones that say that our CIA killed Kennedy, or the Watergate scandal, those kinds of things, and the false advertising about the Iraq war, and so many of these things have just undermined faith in our government today, undermined confidence. Who thinks we really have justice in our courts today? Justice? It can be bought if you have a fat enough wallet, can't it? Yes. And then what about the religious leaders in our world today? All the scandals there, and look what the Church of God has experienced, where our own leaders tried to deceive us on purpose. You can see what's happened to us as a people. We used to trust the media. We thought the media, why, they were our watchdogs, weren't they? Watching over government and watching over things, and they would report the right stuff. And we find out the New York Times has written totally fabricated articles. We see the Dan Rather experience. And we see Newsweek that now writes things that caused rioting and deaths. We can't trust the media either, can we? 1 Timothy 6, if you will. Distrust, it's becoming a way of life in America today. You know what people trust in now? No longer God. No longer science. No longer governments. They trust in money. We're a materialistic society today. We live in a materialistic world. And you see people that have money today, and they do carry with them a kind of air of confidence, don't they? A belief system that they have, because they feel good about the game that they play. 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, he says this: command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. And so Jesus calls riches uncertain riches. And boy, they are, aren't they? You never know when your investments are going to take a turn. And the Depression, the Great Depression, was a good example of this, where people literally jumped out of windows because they lost their money. Why? Because money was everything to them. That's what they trusted in. And so they lost everything. I see it as a tragic insult to those who love them, their loved ones and family. I really do. Let's go over to Mark 10. Mark 10. Realize that we today live in probably a high point, a golden age in American history. And it is a time of great prosperity. We've never really had it so good. But I think that this prosperity we've grown up with has had a profound effect on the Church of God. Could it be that this standard of living we have has affected our standards? What we value? I think it can. I think it can blind us to a certain degree of the need to trust in God. And so in Mark 10, it says this in verse 17. Mark 10, verse 17. Now as he was going out of the road, that is Jesus Christ, one came running and knelt before him and asked him, "Good teacher, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, and that is God. You know the commandments: do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, don't defraud, honor your mother and father." And the man answered and he said to him, "Teacher, all these things have I observed from my youth." And Jesus, looking at him, loved him, and he said to him, "One thing you lack. Go your way and sell whatever you have and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. And come and take up the cross and follow me." And he was sad at his word, and he went away grieved, for he had great possessions. And Jesus looked around and he said to his disciples, "How hard it is for those who have riches to enter the kingdom." And the disciples were astonished at his works. But Jesus answered again unto them, "Children, how hard is it for those who trust in riches to enter the kingdom of God?" Yes, people trust in their riches today. This man couldn't see it, could he? He couldn't see what Jesus could see inside of him. He actually thought he was acknowledging God in all his ways, but he didn't see what Jesus said or saw in him, that he was covetousness, that he trusted in his money. He thought he was rich and increased with goods and in need of nothing. We can't allow ourselves to fall into a trap such as this at the end of the age. And I remind us, the church at the end says they're rich and increased with goods, and that they have need of nothing. They must be well off to be able to say this. I say we all are. We live like kings today in America, don't we? We live so well, it's unbelievable when you compare us to the rest of the world. But once we have money, what happens to us? Changes our thinking, doesn't it? We become more confident in it. It matters. And we see that other people reflect that in their relation to us. Today, we live in a world of rampant materialism. And I say it's affected the Church of God, and I believe that our vision has become blurred and somewhat distracted to a degree. I remember a time when I was distracted by money. I had been in the church for a few years. I was tithing faithfully and always wanted to have a house. I never could have one. I just couldn't make ends meet. I was struggling all the time, just couldn't get my head above water. And at that time, we went through what the church looks back on and says was a liberal era. And so people were bantering around different ideas about tithing and that we didn't need to. And so I kind of picked up on this, and I wanted to get a house. And so I said, I'm going to kind of cut back on my tithing. And I did. And I still didn't have any money, and I couldn't make ends meet. And I was going down the tubes. I was going down the drain financially. I remember to this day the decision I made. And I remember what I said that day. Because I took the family and I assembled everyone and I said, you know what? We're going down the drain financially. And if I'm going down the drain financially, I'm going to do it tithing. I'm going to do it serving God. We're going down the drain. Let's go together. And you know what? It's funny. 6 months later, I had a house. I had moved into a home of my own. And money just kind of drifted in from different sources that I didn't think of. I didn't even think about this until it was much later and make the connection that it was related to my faith. But now I look back and I see that it was. Let's turn to Psalm 73. I learned a lesson in retrospect here that I think is a valuable lesson for all of us. No question, I learned to trust God in that case. And David learned a lesson that was similar. And so when I read this account, I remembered my experience in Psalm 73. And what happened to me? I almost slipped. I almost got off track there. And David almost slipped too. And he says so right here. In verse 1 through 14, truly God is a good to Israel, to such as are of a pure heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the boastful. When I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there's no pangs in their death, but their strength seems firm. They're not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride serves as their necklace, and violence covers them like a garment. Oh yeah, they'll do anything to get ahead, and they'll destroy another company. They'll take a widow's house. They don't care. Violence covers them like a garment, and their eyes bulge with abundance, and they have more heart than they could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily and set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walks through the earth. Oh yeah, there's a certain confidence that comes with having big bucks. Therefore, his people return here, and waters of a full cup are drained by them. They take everything they can, and they say, how does God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the ungodly, who are always at ease, and they increase in riches in this earth, in this system. Surely, they say, he says, this is David speaking, surely I've cleaned my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence, for all day long I've been plagued and chastened every morning. So David almost went off the edge here. He envied the prosperity of those who were wicked. It pained him. And he was, what? Leaning to his own understanding here, wasn't he? He was looking at it humanly. And so it continues on in verse 15. If I had said, I'll speak thus, behold, I would have been untrue in the generation of your children. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. It seemed so unjust, so unfair, until I went to the sanctuary of God. Then I understood something. I understood their end. Surely you set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. Oh, how they're brought to desolation, as in a moment they're utterly consumed with terrors. As a dream when one awakes, so, Lord, when you awake, you will despise their image. Eventually, David came to see the truth. He saw their end, as it were. Their ultimate end is nothing like our end. We are called for a special purpose. You and I, we're in training for something so monumental and so enormous and so transcendent that the riches are not going to be allowed to spoil us. We have a different end. And so David says, thus my heart was grieved, and I was vexed in my mind. I was so foolish, and I was so ignorant. I was like a beast before you, just carnal. That's all he was, carnal. Nevertheless, I'm continually with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterwards, you will receive me to glory. Wow. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is none upon the earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For indeed those who are far from you shall perish. You've destroyed all those who desert you for harlotry. But it's good for me to draw near to God. I put my trust in the Lord God, that I may declare all your works. Wow. Good point. Psalm 75, David learned a lesson, but he didn't learn it in a moment. He learned it over time. We need not be jealous of those that have more than us in this world now, those who prosper, because they're not being prepared for anything. So we need to learn from this example and not lean to our own understanding. Instead, acknowledge him in everything we do. Yes, we are in God's hands. We should trust him with our whole heart. And we can trust him, even for our physical needs. Psalm 75 and verse 6. Where does it all come from? For exaltation, or it says promotion, comes neither, in the King James that is, promotion comes neither from the east nor from the west or from the south. Well, where does God live? He lives in the north, doesn't he? But God is the judge. He puts down one and he exalts the other. And so we can trust in him. He's going to raise one up or put one down or put us in the place we belong, where we belong and where He wants us. Yes. Money's important. It has its place, but it cannot make us secure. It's uncertain. Riches are uncertain. It doesn't make us who we are. Money or our status doesn't define us. What does? The highest calling anyone could ever have. The fact that God loves us, that He gave Himself for us, that we have a chance to be in the first resurrection. This is our identity, and this is who we are. Not how much money we have. Oh, those people out in the world, they don't know who you are. They don't have any idea. And so everywhere you go, they don't understand. If they knew who we were, they would give you immense respect when you pulled into the gas station or went into the liquor store. They would. One day they'll bow, won't they? But they don't know. And so we go in this world unnoticed, uncared for sometimes, and seemingly not prospering like the wicked. Psalm 56. And then we have cases where, of course, in life, we go through life and sometimes people take offense at us, don't they? Because we won't lie for them at work. We won't cover the mistakes. We sometimes take days off when they need us, and they resent that. How can you say no to me when I'm paying you? And so people will sometimes hassle you, won't they, at work. They'll even set up traps, won't they? Just remember how Daniel was? They resented him. Why was he able to get away with these things? And so they set up a trap for him. They'll do that at work. I'm sure all of us, to one degree or another, have seen the company politics. Sure. What happens when the pressure's on, though, for all of us? What do? Sometimes we fear loss of our jobs, don't we? And we have certain fears. We get afraid of things in life. We all have fears of one kind or another. What happens? Do we join in the politics? Do we fight back? Or do we trust God, who promotes one and demotes another? Sometimes we don't acknowledge Him in all our ways. Sometimes we don't let Him direct our steps. But the truth is this: God can do virtually anything and whatever He allows over us. It's really okay. There's something there to be gleaned, something there for us to learn, and something for us to experience, because He is working with us in a process that is a journey of faith, a journey of trust. Psalm 56 and verse 1. 56 and verse 1. Be merciful to me, O God, for man would swallow me up. Fighting all day long, he oppresses me. My enemies would hound me all day, for there are many who fight against me, O Most High. And wherever I'm afraid, I will trust in you. Let's go over to Luke 12. Luke 12. I want us to remember the words of Jesus. I know they're familiar, and I know some will think, well, this sounds extreme. But it isn't necessarily all that extreme. What's the worst thing that anyone can do to you? What's the worst they can do? Torture you? Kill you? They can do that, I guess. But I say this, God allows it. It's okay, you're ready. It's a good thing. 12:14, Luke 12 and verse 14. Luke 4. Forgive me for that. He says unto you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that no more that they can do. But I'll show you whom you should fear. Fear him who, after he is killed, has power to cast into hell, that is, the lake of fire. Yes, I say unto you, fear him. Fear him. Now, I know that sounds extreme. But it really is true when we come to understand his next statement. Look at verse 6. Look at verse 6. Are not five sparrows sold for two copper coins? And not one of them is forgotten before God. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Don't fear, therefore. You're of much more value than any of these sparrows. This, I believe, is a great truth. One we don't always see. And that is God's complete and absolute sovereignty over our lives. We don't see that he's in complete control over everything. And that's why we don't acknowledge him in all our ways. And that's why we lean to our own understanding. And that's why we direct our own paths. But God says, don't lean to your own understanding. Because when you lean, something leans, it grows in that direction. And that's what happens to us. We will be with God, we'll lean to our own understanding, and we begin to divide, we split, and we develop a dichotomy, a kind of wall that separates us. We become, as you were, if you let me say it, schizophrenic spiritually. We divide what is secular and what is sacred in our lives. And so we put a difference in the church life and our secular life. A difference in how we think God sees us and how we see ourselves. We see ourselves and we care about how God sees us at church, but how much do we care about how he sees us when we're at work? We think, for instance, that God cares about which church it is we give our money to, but we're not so concerned exactly how we earn the money and what kind of job we do while we're working to earn it. We believe God cares about us reading the Bible, but we don't think he cares so much about what we view on television. So we think about him caring about the way we pray to him, but we don't think so much about how we talk to others or how we talk to our mates sometimes. You see? We have this dichotomy that goes on. And a wall that separates the two sides of us. There is the dark side, as I call it sometimes. My point is, the wall suits us though, doesn't it? Because aren't there places where sometimes we don't want God to go? Places we don't want him necessarily involved in our lives? We have some of those places, don't we? Yes. Ask us today, will you look at this honestly? Are there any places in your life where you're not acknowledging God? Are there any places where we don't trust him? And the reason we don't is because we think there's something we might lose out on. And the fears we have, they lead us to doubt. They lead us to not trust because we're afraid we won't get what we want. We'll lose out on something that we think is important. God tells us, break down the walls. We've got to come to trust him in everything, include him in every decision, and acknowledge him in all our ways. We must not become like the physics professor, where when we think harm's going to come to us, we dodge out of the way. We have to believe what God says. Those laws of God are absolute and even more absolute than the laws of physics. The professor need not have moved, and we need not to move either. No matter what happens, we should do God's will. Now look, I know it's a heavy burden. We don't all start with that kind of trust, do we? No. No, we don't. It's a process. I know in one sense we made this commitment at baptism. We realized we couldn't be trusted, didn't we? Yes. We can't trust ourselves. And we made a commitment. we're going to go your way, God, and we're going to do it your way, and we're going to acknowledge you in all our ways. We're going to trust you, and we believe in you, and we're going to do this. And we started out that way, and we put the old man to death and so on. But then what happens? We committed to putting our whole life in his hands. But then time goes by, and we kind of forget. And then a crisis comes up, and we get afraid, and we go back to doubt. The old man comes back, doesn't he? Genesis 12, if you will. We become afraid, and this is something that all of us do. Every one of us have fears. Every one of you have a fear, something that you're afraid of. It can and it does happen to all of us. There are times when we don't trust God. Now, Abraham, he was the father of the faithful, wasn't he? Yes. But did Abraham have fears? Did he ever doubt? Were there times when he didn't trust God? Let's have a look. Doubt led him to not trust God in verse 10 of chapter 12. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarah, his wife, indeed I know that you're a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife, and they'll kill me, but they'll let you live. Please say that you're my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. Abraham feared for his life, and he put his wife in jeopardy that some other man might use her. Why? To protect himself. To protect himself. Now, God could have protected him, couldn't he? Easily. But he feared. And the doubt led to lack of trust and lying to protect himself. So what about us? You ever lie to protect yourself? You ever color the truth? Ever kind of fudge a little bit on taxes because it's to our benefit? Do we ever do any of this kind of stuff? See, Abraham didn't fully trust God right from the beginning. He eventually came to trust God, but it took many years. Genesis 16. Abraham had another fear. He feared that he'd never have the son of promise. The result? He leaned to his own understanding, and he directed his own ways. Genesis 16, now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abram, see now the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of his wife. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. And so it was that he took her and had a child by Hagar. He should have waited, shouldn't he? Should have waited. Let's see what God's going to do. But he took measures into his own hands, and he went into Hagar. Does this ever happen to you? Do you ever think that what you want to come doesn't come? And do you rush to judgment sometimes? Do we make decisions beforehand? You ever buy something because the right thing didn't come along, you didn't think it would, and you buy it, and then later it does come along? How many times do we rush the job and we have to do it all over again? There's never enough time to do it right. Always enough time to do it over again. And this is that same principle, isn't it? Are we doing it God's way, or have we taken matters into our own hands? Are we acknowledging Him, or are we leaning to our own understanding? It happens over and over again. And so it was, so we take shortcuts that we have to repair later. And so did he, and it's never been repaired, and it won't be repaired until Jesus Christ returns. But Abraham was growing in this time towards his trust. And finally now a big test was going to come on him. And let's move over to Genesis 17. God came to him and said, Sarah is going to bear a child. What do you think his response was? Oh, great. Finally, God's going to come through. You think that was his response? It was disbelief. Laughter, actually, Genesis 17 and verse 15. And God said to Abram, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, and I'll bless her, and also give you a son by her, and I'll bless her. And she'll be the mother of nations, and kings of people shall come from her. And Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born of a man that's 100 years old, and Sarah, who's 90 years old, bear a child? And so you see the point I make. Abraham was going through a process, the father of the faithful. Then finally, Sarah did bear a son, didn't she? The son of promise. And then Abraham began to get the message. And so God was going to bring him, finally, to this last, final test. And he commanded Abraham to sacrifice his son. But I think at this point, Abraham had seen enough, didn't he? He had been protected from Pharaoh by God, because God came to him in a dream. He had seen that, in fact, he had gotten the victory over those kings that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah and took Lot. This God had been with him. He had protected Lot from the devastation of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he had given him the son of old age. And it began to get the message. Now Abraham said, I can trust him. Yes, even with my whole heart. And so Abraham came to a point after decades where he finally was ready for this test. And there God came to him and said, I want you to take that son you love so very much, and I want you to sacrifice him. And he no longer distrusted God, did he? You know what Hebrews says? Abraham thought, well, he'll raise him up again. He knew God would fulfill his promise. He no longer was afraid. And so Genesis 22, and starting in verse 9, says this. Genesis 22 and verse 9 says this. And they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son, and he laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you've not withheld your son, your only son from me. I want us today to really think about what happened here. God said to Abraham, now I know. I never understood this right in the past. I used to use this as a proof text to show that we had free will, and God didn't know what we were going to do until we did it. Oh, there's so much more meaning here than I ever understood. No, God didn't know Abraham would do the right thing before this. He didn't know for decades until he worked with him and worked with him and worked with him, and then God knew before he tested him, didn't he? And he went through the test and he said, now I know. I know he will trust me. Remember what he said later? I know Abraham. He'll teach his children and his children's children to keep my laws. God knew that Abraham had come to a point where now, no matter what God said, he was going to do it, no matter the consequences, he trusted God with his whole heart, and he no longer leaned to his own understanding. But he acknowledged God in everything, in every decision he made. And he trusted him and let God direct his paths. He had no other fears. Why? because he had come to the point where he feared God more than anything else in his life. In the past, he feared Pharaoh. In the past, he feared not having the son. But now he had come to the point where now he stood in awe of this great God. And he trusted him no matter what. All the time before, God was working with him, developing the trust, working with him, proving himself. So I say to this to all of us today, don't be dismayed if you had a relapse. Don't be dismayed if you failed or if you doubted or if you failed to trust God sometime along the way. It's a part of a journey of trust. It is part of a journey of faith. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to do things like Abraham did. But make no mistake about this. You and I will come to the same place that Abraham came to. The point where we trust God with all of our heart. It may take time. It may take some lessons. It may take some mistakes. You and I are going to get there, just like David did. He learned lessons, and he developed total faith in God. He lost everything before it happened. Abraham learned, and Job learned through what he went through until he came to a point where he said, if he slays me, I'll trust him. Whatever he does is okay. It's the right thing. We will come to that place, a journey of faith. The more that we trust in him, the more we're going to have a liberating peace in our lives. He calls it a peace that passes all understanding. Because we're not going to be faced with the anxieties and burdened with all of the worries because we're going to trust in him. Now, there's a story that illustrates this to me fairly well. Of course, it's a made-up story, but it's a beautiful example of a man who was walking in a town and ran across death. And he said, "Death, what are you going to do?" And Death said, "I'm going to take 100 lives." And he said, "That's horrible. That's horrible. How can you do that?" And Death said, "That's what I do. I take lives. I'm going into the town." So the man rushed into the town, and he tried to warn everybody he could to try to prevent Death from taking the lives of these people. And he came out later in the evening, and once again he saw Death coming out of the town. And he said, "You lied. You lied to me. You said you were only going to take 100, and 1,000 died." And Death said to him, "I didn't lie to you. I kept my word. I took 100. Worry took the rest." And it's true. We're so stressed out in our age today, in our world today. We have to take all kinds of medications. We have heart stress, diseases of all kinds. It's all because of worry. It's killing us. We don't have to worry. We don't have to. We can trust God with absolute faith. Trust him, and he will take care of us. Life is filled with uncertainty. You never know what's going to befall you next, do you? What's behind the curtain of tomorrow? It rises, and you never know. Maybe you'll have poverty, and maybe you'll have wealth. Maybe you'll have health, or maybe you'll have illness. You don't know what's going to happen, but one single thing, and only one thing, can you and I count on in our lives, and that is one thing is this: the love of God. That's all there really is. We have to trust that he loves us and has a future for us, and that he has a plan and all the power in the universe, and he's going to use the power that he has to bring sons and daughters into his family and into his kingdom. And that's what he's all about, and he will stop at nothing to accomplish this. He won't. And he is working in your life today just like he worked with David. He's working in your life today, just like he worked with Abraham. And you and I were in different places, different degrees, along that road, that journey to trust and to faith. But we're all going to have the same end result. We're going to believe, and we're going to have faith. And we're going to know. It's not just a theory, is it? It's not theoretical. It's reality. And you and I will come to that point that all of these great men and women of the Bible came to. He has started a work in us. He's going to perform it. And I ask us today to think about this. Why resist? Why are we resisting? Why are we keeping the wall up? Why aren't we trusting him more, seeing we know this? You do see it, don't you? There is no better way. No better investment in your life. There's no more lofty or worthy ideal than this that we have been called to. There's nothing better than we could ever do in our life than to trust him with all of our heart, to lean not to our own understanding, to acknowledge him in all our ways, and to let him direct our paths.